Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Another day of the doldrums on Wall Street, like it's just too deep into the August heat for investors to even fan themselves. But winds are blowing in the wider economy. Problem is, they're blowing in every direction, and it's hard to know when things might cool off. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 22nd of August. Ever date somebody who couldn't seem to keep their story straight? Well, consider that a metaphor for today's economy, and you've got the makings of a turbulent relationship between Americans and their money. Just today, there was more conflicted news out of the nation's central bank, and that's got our senior business correspondent Bob Moon groaning, "Enough already." He is ready for a breakup, unless he sees some commitment to economic recovery. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Tess.
So what's your problem? You know, nothing's perfect, especially not the economy, right?
Well, you know, there's this song I was listening to the other day about a guy who's fed up with the way things are going in his relationship.
'Cause I can't take no more of your talk.
And I think Michael Franks there pretty much sums up the way a lot of us feel about our relationship with the economy lately. Mm. We've been getting mixed signals month after month, so it's no wonder the consumer confidence surveys basically stalled since June.
Well, so what kind of signals were you getting from today's news? How are you feeling today?
Just more mixed signals, Tess. No. Wall Street was in the doldrums all morning on more discouraging economic signals from both Europe and Asia.
But wait a minute. Yeah. Doldrums, aren't we also in the middle of summer? Isn't everybody on vacation?
Well, that's true. That's true. But Japan's exports fell in July, and that pushed the country back into a trade deficit last month. Hmm. Then stocks took off like a rocket when the minutes were released from the last meeting of the Federal Reserve.
Right.
They suggested that many Fed members were talking about the need for further economic support coming fairly soon. Now, that could mean the Fed will open the spigot on its cheap money again. But after the initial euphoria, it seems some traders also saw that as a dark sign that the Fed is starting to lose hope and it doesn't have many tricks left to turn things around.
So even in just a single report, we have either yay or oh, dear.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's talk about housing for a moment, because we've had some news out of that sector recently. And in fact, we've, you know, actually had some economists calling the bottom on this thing.
That's right. And I'll give you that. The National Association of Realtors reports that home resales rose by a healthy 2.3% in July, and the median price rose above $187,000, which is more than 9% higher than the same time last year. Hmm. You can largely thank record low interest rates for helping spur that rise. But then the Mortgage Bankers Association comes and whispers in my other ear.
Uh-oh.
And applications for U.S. home mortgages tumbled last week. That reflects activity in both refinancing demand and new home purchases. And those applications actually fell more than 7% in the past week. At the same time, mortgage rates started to edge back up.
Oh, dear. So I'm guessing you don't know which story you're going to put your faith in.
That's right.
That what's going on here? All right. Well, didn't we also hear just recently that wages are rising? Consumer spending is also up. Those back-to-school sales apparently got people into the stores. So what's wrong with all that?
Well, true. Wages have been growing at an annualized rate of 7.5%. That's the best in 5 years, which could explain the modest rise in consumer spending last month. But what's going to happen if oil prices keep rising as they did again today? Prices at the pump are up at an annual rate of nearly 12% since February. And today, the U.S. government reported crude inventories in this country dropped more than expected for the fourth straight week. Hmm. That sent benchmark prices back up more than a quarter per barrel today. That's what I mean by having this love-hate relationship with the economy.
Well, all right. So brass tacks here, Bob. Are you going to break up with the economy or not?
Well, first of all, it's not like I have any choice, right?
Well, that's true. You're kind of stuck.
Yeah, but I am ever the optimist. So as long as things don't stray too far, I guess I'm in it to stay. But check back with me again real soon.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Tess.
President Obama and Governor Romney are traveling around the country to rally the middle class vote. A report out today from the Pew Charitable Trusts finds both candidates are preaching to a group that is very worried about maintaining its middle class status, and for good reason. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Shireen Marisol Meraji has more.
85% of the middle class Americans surveyed by Pew said it's harder to stay middle class these days.
This sense of stagnation in life that the middle class feels. It's very real. It's very sharp. It's supported by data.
Paul Taylor is the executive vice president of the Pew Research Center. Pew looked at census and Federal Reserve data and found that the middle class ended the last decade
with less in median annual income than it had at the start. A lot less wealth than it had at the start. It shrunk in size.
And Taylor says you can't blame it all on the Great Recession. Data shows that middle class income has been stagnant for years.
My name is Sarah Pankowski, and my age is 71.
Older middle class Americans, like Florida resident Sarah Pankowski, felt the most secure in their status during this rough decade.
I own my own home.
They bought their homes before the bubble, paid off their mortgages, and live on a combination of retirement pensions and Social Security. But Pankowski says her children are much less secure.
It hasn't lived up to their expectations, the American dream.
Charles Carter. I'm Sarah Pankowski's son.
Carter went back to school in his late 40s because he wanted a better job. He's finishing up his master's degree in elementary education and drained his retirement and savings to do it.
I am frustrated, but at the same time, it's still one of the greatest countries in the world. It's not the greatest, and so I'm glad to be living here, but it's frustrating when you know it could be so much better, you know?
That frustration mixed with muted optimism is a theme in the study. 67% of middle-class Americans surveyed still believe with hard work, you can get ahead. I'm Shereen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Mexico is dealing with a big problem right now, and it has nothing to do with narco traffickers or political instability. No, the big issue is an egg shortage. An outbreak of avian flu has devastated the Mexican poultry industry, driving down the egg supply in a country that consumes more eggs per capita than anywhere else in the world. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler starts his report in the kitchen.
Almost every day at our building's cafe, I order eggs with chorizo. Like most Americans, I eat lots of eggs. But Mexicans have us beat. Jim Sumner is president of the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council.
Their total consumption is about 385 eggs per capita. It's amazing. I don't know how they consume so many.
Price is one reason.
It's a cheap meal.
Gustavo Arellano is author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America.
Growing up, we always had eggs with everything. Egg accentuates and combines with so many different foods that you can never get tired of using eggs. Huevos con chorizo, huevos con nopales, huevos con arroz, huevos con huevos.
Egg prices have doubled in some parts of Mexico, but Arellano says Mexican consumers won't be deterred.
They're not going to give up the eggs. If you're going to have to pay more for eggs, you're probably going to have to scrimp on beef or some other meal.
This might normally be an opportunity for U.S. egg producers, but drought and high temperatures mean a tight market for eggs in this country, too. Jim Sumner with the Egg Export Council says U.S. producers can adapt.
There may be an opportunity for our industry to even gear up its production somewhat to help fulfill these needs.
Producers in the U.S. plan to send about 300 truckloads of eggs to Mexico. They sent the first trial load today. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, stocks climbed back just barely from earlier losses. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. Every couple of weeks, we talk with Stephen Dubner, co-author of the books and the blog about the hidden side of everything. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Tess. You having a nice, calm, peaceful, productive day at the office today?
It's a newsroom, Stephen. No such thing, right? Although we are in the dog days of summer.
Let me ask you this, Tess. You ever fantasize about just working from home instead, maybe setting up a little radio studio in your living room and you could, you know, look at your scripts from your favorite easy chair? Doesn't that sound nice?
With my cat on my lap. Well, just between us, because nobody's listening.
Yep.
Yeah, I think about it all the time, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, you know, bosses tend to have a kind of standard line of thinking here that, you know, left to your own devices, you'd spend all day, you know, watching cat videos or watering the garden, whatever.
Yeah, and?
That's why it's sometimes called shirking from home rather than working from home. But today, I come, Tess, bearing evidence that working from home might actually be a great
Tess,
idea.
Sorry to interrupt. I know you're talking to Stephen.
Patty,
reporting trip.
Patty.
Yeah, I know.
I'm on air.
I know.
Patty.
We need to fix this. We need to, either need to fix this.
Stephen, I'm really sorry. Patty,
sorry.
You need to give
no
us
worries.
A moment.
All right. Yep.
All right. Please continue.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So I wanted to tell you about an interesting experiment, okay, at a Chinese company called Ctrip. It's basically the Chinese version of Expedia, the travel website. It's based in Shanghai. The company's got about 14,000 employees. Here is the company's co-founder and chairman, James Liang.
The real estate in Shanghai is getting very expensive. We're thinking maybe we should move some people off home when the technology is ready. Then we thought, hey, this might be a very interesting academic subject if we can do it more scientifically.
Okay, so you've got a boss here who's thinking about saving on office rent by letting some people work at home. But Liang is not your typical boss. He was actually taking a break from running the company to get a PhD in economics at Stanford, okay? And that's where he met a labor economist named Nick Bloom, and they decided to set up this work-at-home option as a real experiment. So what they did is they recruited 500 Ctrip volunteers, employees, half of whom were then randomly selected to work at home for the next 9 months, mm-hmm. and the rest, which became the control group, they would keep working in the office. Now, here is Nick Bloom talking about what the company expected to get out of this experiment.
Their view is they'd save a lot of money on space, they'd save a lot of money on lower attrition, but they'd lose on productivity. And in fact, productivity went up.
Productivity went up? You were working at home yes. and your productivity goes up.
Exactly. Now keep in mind, these Ctrip workers were essentially call center employees, okay? Not all jobs are as easily transferred to home
sure.
as that. But that said, the home workers, the people who worked at home, were about 13% more productive than an equivalent group of office workers. Here's Bloom again.
They also started and stopped on time because they didn't turn up late because commuting or the plumber didn't turn up or they were sick, etc.
Right. So some of the gains tests came from people simply working more hours at home, but home workers were also more efficient. Now you say, well, how can that be?
Right.
Here is Bloom's explanation for that.
In the office, it's very noisy. You can hear the guy on the phone next door to you on the phone call, the person across the desk, you know, crying because their boyfriend has just split up with them. It's horribly distracting.
Now, Tess, Bloom does make the important point that not all employees have the same preferences, of course. Some
sure.
people, you and me maybe, want to work at home and will perform better there. Others, you know, want to work in an office and will perform better there.
Right. So Stephen, really what you're saying
Tess,
here is...
Are you coming in to say goodbye to the interns?
Patty, I'm in the middle of work.
They've got red velvet cake.
Well, despite that, I really need you to let me finish this interview. Sorry. I'll be right there, really.
All right.
Okay.
Sounds like you've got a little bit of experience with office distractions yourself, Tess.
Just a few cupcakes, but nevertheless.
Yeah. Now, that said, it would be naive to think that home workers don't also get distracted, but the evidence here suggests that as distracting as home may be, the office, as you've experienced today, is even worse.
Indeed.
And on a different dimension, getting to work can be bad for you too. Okay, so here's Christine Hayner. She's a professor of public health at Washington University. She recently finished a study on the health effects of commuting.
So we found that people who commuted longer distances were less physically active, less physically fit, weighed more, and had higher blood pressure than people who had shorter commute distances.
Whoa!
So Tess, there you've got
it. We really need to sort this Joplin thing out, okay? It's either the 22nd or the 15th of September. Would you make a decision, for heaven's sake?
Okay, let's go with the 15th.
All right,
are we
you.
Done now? Okay,
yeah,
thank
done.
You. Okay, Stephen.
Tess, you ready to work at home?
I think I just might
have
be.
I won you over?
Where do I sign up? Stephen Dubner, our Freakonomics correspondent. He puts out a podcast, too. You can get that on iTunes and hear more at Freakonomics.com. Stephen, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
I hope so. Thanks.
Coming up, how is your salary determined anyway?
I think it's part science and it's part art.
Our payday series continues, but first, let's do the numbers. Markets declined early but recovered after the Federal Reserve released minutes showing support for further action if the economy doesn't improve. The Dow trimmed its loss to 30 points, a quarter of a percent, to finish at 13,172. The Nasdaq was up 6 points, 0.2% at 3,073, and the S&P was flat, closing at 1413. Bank stocks fell broadly. Citigroup was off 0.75%. Goldman Sachs fell 0.6%. J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo were down more than 0.5%. Home builders had a good day, though. Toll Brothers, a builder of upscale homes, reported a sharp jump in orders, opening the door to a 4% increase for its shares. D.R. Horton added more than 4%, as did Pulte Group. Bond prices rose as the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.70%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for July. It's the United Nations International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition. And he conveyed a lot without words. Film star Rudolph Valentino died on August 23, 1926, in New York. He was 31. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. When big movies are filmed in small towns, they can pour money into the local economy. Crews need to be fed, housed, moved about, and entertained. Productions need extras. Every once in a while, a local gets cast in a speaking part. Some movies even leave a footprint long after the cameras are gone. Santa Barbara Wine Country saw a huge influx of tourists after Sideways. But not every production leaves a sweet taste in locals' mouths. Film producer Corey Wells and director Kevin Walker decided to make a documentary about one such movie and the people it portrayed. Corey filed this story about her film, The Deliverance of Raven County.
The folks in Raven County, Georgia, put on the Chattooga River Festival this past June to encourage people to visit and take care of their river. But it wasn't the moonshine tasting or the banjo picking that got me and my partner, Kevin Walker, out to this lush, green, mountainous part of the state. It was deliverance. The movie was shot on and around the Chattooga 40 years ago this year, and they were using that as the hook for the festival. What Sarah Gillespie and the others who helped put the event together didn't count on was how it would split the community.
We had a commissioner's meeting, and someone stood up and was very emotional and said that the movie had ruined her life.
I heard stories of people being passed up for jobs because they came from Raven County. And those negative images have been reinforced by 40 years of deliverance jokes.
How many of you have seen the documentary Deliverance?
Squeal, piggy, squeal. You got a pretty mouth.
But not everyone has bad feelings about deliverance. And that includes Billy Redden, the backwoods-looking boy who played dueling banjos with Ronnie Cox in the film.
Talk about genetic deficiencies. Isn't that pitiful?
Billy's 55 years old now, and he says deliverance was the best thing that ever happened to him. But that doesn't mean he saw much money from it.
I'd like to have all the money that I thought I made in this movie. I wouldn't be working at Walmart right now. I'm struggling very hard to make ends meet.
Billy didn't make a lot from Deliverance, but Raven County did. Before the movie came out, the number of people who visited the Chattooga was in the hundreds. Afterwards, it was in the tens of thousands. Rafting is now a $20 million industry here, and tourism is the area's number one source of revenue. So you can understand why the organizers of the Chattooga River Festival decided to highlight the film. But you can also understand the objections.
How you justifying making fun of a culture and a people and then saying it's okay because you're paying them.
Tammy Whitmire is a county official who's lived in the area since she was 9 and married a man whose family's been here for 15 generations. But she refused to support the Chattooga River Festival because of deliverance.
You know, what is it worth? Is it worth a few dollars for people around the world to think that that's what we are here? No.
But it's more than just a few dollars. Then-Governor Jimmy Carter established a film commission in Georgia after Deliverance came out. And since then, the state's become one of the top 5 production destinations in the U.S. And it's not just movie money that's been drawn to this part of the state. It's people with money. These days, million-dollar vacation homes line the shores of the area's lakes. You can understand why city folk might want to have a place in these parts. The Chattooga is beautiful, unbelievably beautiful. On a raft ride down the river, our guide pointed to a tree-lined bank and said, "That's where the rape scene was filmed." And 40 years after Deliverance hit theaters, that's still the issue. Can this gorgeous river and the disturbing scenes that were filmed here ever be separated? Do they need to be? Sarah Gillespie.
Well, Deliverance is a significant part of our history, good or bad. It was filmed here. I mean, stereotypes are stereotypes. They're in every single movie you'll ever see in your life.
For what it's worth, my partner Kevin and I found the stereotypes to be anything but true. We met so many great people in Raven County, especially Billy Redden, the banjo boy.
We're not a bad people up here. We're loving people. We get along with everybody. And like up here, we all get along together because we all know one another. A real peaceful town.
In Raven County, Georgia, I'm Corey Wells for Marketplace.
A version of this story originally aired on KCRW's The Business. If you're one of the lucky folks with a job in this economy, take a moment now to picture your paycheck. It's one of the most important numbers for any of us, the one right after the word net on a pay stub. But where does that number come from?
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
This week, our Wealth and Poverty Desk is unraveling the mysteries of why we're paid and what we're paid. And Marketplace's David Brancaccio reports there is often a hidden game shaping your compensation, one that could stand in the way of your next raise if you don't know how to play it.
When it came to negotiating her first big job after college, Yelena Schur did everything just right, almost everything. Her only mistake was last Thanksgiving when a relative got her to crack.
It was my aunt. She is quite blunt, to say the least.
Yelena was about to graduate from Cornell's School of Industrial and Labor Relations and already had what she considered a great job lined up in her chosen field of human resources. But under cross-examination, Yelena broke the great American taboo.
And she asked me how much I'm making, and it was kind of just silent at the table. And meanwhile, my mom was kind of shaking her head, telling me not to tell her. And when I told my aunt what I make, her reaction was, "Oh, so little? Well, that's okay. I mean, in a few years, you'll have a raise."
Ouch.
Yes.
She won't make that mistake again, but here's what Yelena got right. At Cornell, she had studied the mysteries of how companies are supposed to set pay.
There's a whole bunch of number crunching that goes into it by, like, looking at what competitors pay and what a certain job is valued within a company.
Modern organizations try to get systematic about paychecks. So when it came to her own job search, Yelena knew how to use this system and came up with a salary goal of
$50,000, between $50,000 and $55,000.
When a prominent business consulting firm in Manhattan offered a sweet human resources job, the salary was right on the money. Yelena still tried some negotiating and brought up maybe a relocation bonus. The company said, nah, since she was moving just a few subway stops from Brooklyn to Manhattan. But it's clear Yelena never did have much room to maneuver. You see, the job for which she was applying was a pretty clear-cut position, entry-level human resources. Economist Kevin Halleck was Yelena's professor at Cornell.
If it's a very specific skill set and a very specific task that's being done, I think it's more straightforward to pay the person.
The science starts with a little side business you may never have heard of. It's possible that right now your employer is making extra money selling a database of what you and your colleagues make. No names, but listed by the kind of work you do. Other companies buy that data to reality check their salaries. Some websites also buy paycheck data and put it online so the rest of us can have what the employer has already.
Now you can negotiate both of you being educated.
Zahir Ladani, the president of Salary.com, says it's like when the real cost of new cars hit the web some years ago.
You go and buy your car, you go to the Kelley Blue Book or any other places you can do. In the same way, with Salary.com, can we get people educated on what that salary is being benchmarked at and how you could grow that?
All this data at play sounds scientific, but here's a revelation from Halleck. Even in the best-run companies, figuring out what to pay people is not just a formula.
I think it's part science and it's part art.
If a job in, for instance, human resources is easy to compare, like, oh, I don't know, a pork belly trading on a commodities market, then a company will know what to pay. But America's workforce is changing, and increasingly, job descriptions are no longer standardized or run-of-the-mill.
In today's economies, some occupations are pretty hard to define. And if it's an occupation that's not common and one that's not used by many others, things are a lot more difficult.
So many jobs are hybrids, like a graphic designer slash marketing consultant, or they're limited edition positions, like the one guy who knows how to keep the machinery going at the Hoover Dam. These are jobs that are more artisanal, handcrafted, less pork belly and more, what should we say, more gourmet sausage. And the more gourmet sausage the job, the less scientific the pay calculation gets. In place of science, the art of negotiation comes in.
It's an incredibly important point for thinking about how to get paid more.
And how do you prep for that negotiation? Halleck has a book coming out in a couple weeks called Pay: Why People Earn What They Earn. He says never walk into a big job meeting without doing this crucial piece of homework.
If an employee can figure out what's important to the organization, what's the organization trying to do, if the employee can make his or herself look useful to that mission, he or she can help themselves in negotiation.
Tomorrow on our series, Payday, Wealth and Poverty's Chrissy Clark takes a look at some paychecks at the bottom of the income scale. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And if you're curious about whether your job is a pork belly or a gourmet sausage, we've got a questionnaire to help you figure it out at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, an historical park in northern Israel is going high-tech. It's strapping Wi-Fi routers onto donkeys that carry tourists through the hills around the Sea of Galilee. So now you can don biblical garb and ride an ancient animal while looking up your location on Wikipedia. But really, if you're out in the middle of the Holy Land and you can't live without a router-carrying donkey so you can tweet and update your Facebook status, well, what you really need is a kick in the... And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 30 points, a quarter of a percent. The Nasdaq added 6 points, two-tenths of a percent. And the S&P 500 ended right where it started. Our engineers include Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.